This is an interview with David Smith for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby. Today is April 16th, 2013. We're talking with David Smith at his home in Scarsdale, New York. Mr. Smith, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
So you just start with a little bit about your early life and education. So where are you from originally?
I was born in Greenfield, Massachusetts. And that was kind of a fluke. We never lived there. My mother's obstetrician was there, and so she gave birth to both my sister and I in Greenfield. And I grew up in Yonkers, New York, on the border of Bronxville, New York, and went to elementary school, PS8 in Yonkers. And then when I was about to go into junior high school, we decided that I would go to the Scarsdale school system. My mother worked for the Board of Education in Scarsdale, so I started in eighth grade in Scarsdale and went to Scarsdale High School, commuting with my mother. And I come from a family involved in education. My father was a high school teacher in Mount Vernon, New York, and today my sister is a college professor. So that's how I got my start in life.
And then where did you attend college?
I attended Amherst College, graduated in 1967, and then went to NYU Law School. I went to law school for a year and then taught in the New York City public school system for 2 years. I taught fourth grade 1 year and fifth grade the next year, and then returned to NYU full-time and graduated in 1972.
When you were there, did you have a particular interest in law or corporate issues, or what did you study in law school?
Well, law school, I took the required courses first year, and I didn't really concentrate in the corporate area. I would say my interest in law maybe started when I was in seventh grade, and we had to do a career project, and I chose to interview a lawyer who was a friend of the family. So that was my first foray into any kind of career interest or career path. I suppose I just as well could have decided to interview a doctor. It just happened I interviewed a lawyer. He was a very nice guy. I was very impressed with him. So that was a good experience. And then I think when I was a junior in college, I was Congressman Richard Ottinger's first intern in Washington, D.C. And the internship program, this was 1965, had just really started. Now I think it's very routine and a very active program, but there weren't so many of us then. So I became interested in law and politics. And so that was always sort of in the back of my mind as I finished college and went into law school. But I didn't really concentrate on corporate law or securities law in law school. So I came out ready to work for any kind of law firm, really anywhere that would hire me in those days, law firm, government, and I ended up at Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. But I didn't grow up in a family that had lawyers. There were no lawyers in my family. They were mostly educators. My uncle was an accountant. We were very middle-class family, and I don't think my parents owned any shares of stock. So it wasn't something that got talked about at the dinner table at all, you know. So that was my profile going into my career after law school.
So you started at Donaldson Lufkin. What was your in Jenrette? What
right.
was your experience there?
It was actually a great experience. DLJ. Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. DLJ had just gone public. They were the first brokerage firm to go public. So they were, you know, they were forging a path that would soon be followed by others. And Bill Donaldson was still there, and you'll hear from me as we talk throughout this interview how my path crossed with Bill's on several occasions throughout my career. So Bill was still there. Dick Jenrette was still there. Lufkin had left to pursue, I think, politics in Connecticut. He had political aspirations that he never realized. And it was a very young place. Everybody seemed about my age or a little older. And it was kind of a heady environment. I mean, they were on a roll. It was the hot issues market. There was just a lot going on. And what was great for me as a young lawyer, they had, because of their growth and going public, they had brought in, to create a legal department, five young men from Davis Polk, who was their outside counsel at the time. And their names don't matter, except one in particular, Michael Boyd, who became general counsel of DLJ, just retired a few years ago. And he was somewhat of a mentor to me. And Michael, I was assigned to Michael. I should just say, I'm the sixth lawyer. Of the six lawyers, four of them were former Rhodes Scholars. So I was, I got good training from good people and very interesting people. Bright bunch. So I always felt that even though I was working in a corporate legal department, which when I started in my career, you went to the top law firm, and in-house corporate attorneys, I wouldn't say they were looked down upon, but it was just not viewed as kind of the same level of practice. I mean, if you came out of law school and went to Davis Polk or Gravath or one of the big firms, that was the right career path for a young lawyer. And so I figured that going to DLJ and having the fortune of being with this smart group from Davis Polk, who were fine young lawyers, I got the kind of law training, if not better, than people who went to a big firm. I was really hands-on, and I was thrown into the fray right away. And my first work was for Alliance Capital, who was just a baby then. If I had stayed with Alliance, of course, I'd be a very wealthy man and wouldn't have time for this interview. So I worked with Mike. Michael was the general counsel of Alliance, so I worked for Michael at Alliance, and he was a great teacher, became a great friend, and you'll hear later, invested in one of my projects that never worked out. So I got very good training, and that was really, now I'm in the securities business as a lawyer.
What sort of things were you doing?
Well, I had to become somewhat of an expert on the Investment Company Act of 1940, which I thought was a bit of a yawn at the time. But I did that for a period of time. And then one of the other young lawyers, not one of the ones from Davis Polk, but we were like a basketball team. I was the sixth man, and the other sixth man, Tom Weiser, he left, and I moved up to DLJ, and I continued to work with Michael, but I became exposed to John Castle, who was running Sprout at the time, who later became chairman of DLJ. I had to deal more with Dick Jenrette, and he was kind of aloof and scary. I remember one day when I was the only lawyer in house, and Dick called me, and he had a question, and I thought I knew the answer. I wasn't sure 100%, but I kind of said, what the heck, and gave him my opinion, which turned out to have been right. So that was fortuitous. I was a little intimidated at first by Dick. Bill, on the other hand, we had a room on the 19th floor. We were at 140 Broadway, and we had a room we called the Fishbowl because it was glass on kind of stuck out of the building. It was glass on three sides, and this was part of the fun. Every Friday, when we were through with a very hectic week, most of us would gather there, and it was the lawyers and the guys doing deals and everything. And they were all young, and we'd have wine, and, you know, that was how we ended our week. And Bill was always there. So that was a fun part of my introduction to working on Wall Street.
Where did you go from there?
I was really there only two or three years, a couple of years really, and I was at a wedding of a friend, and I met a guy from Scarsdale, New York, where I had gone to high school, who I didn't know him. He was the father of friends of mine, and he was the chairman of the board of a company called Seligman & Latz. And Seligman & Latz were looking for a general counsel, and John Cuby, the man's name, John Cuby, asked me if I would be interested in interviewing for the job, and I said yes. I was very happy at DLJ, and I think they were very happy with me, but this was, it was an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things, as a young guy, I had to, and I was married at the time and had a young son, and it was an opportunity, so I had to weigh the opportunity and risk that, you know, was I ready to be a general counsel? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know exactly what that entailed, in fact, but was I ready for this opportunity and growth in my career, or should I stay where I was very happy at DLJ? And I decided to go to Seligman & Latz.
So what did being the general counsel entail?
Well, they had been very disappointed in their general counsel, who had been in private practice, a little older than I was. And I don't know, it was a personality thing, I think, more than competence. And as it turned out, personalities, even though it was a public company, it was relatively small, family-dominated. So, you know, the personality aspect of being at Seligman & Latz was an important ingredient. So that worked out well for me. Our outside law firm was Proskauer, the Proskauer firm. And for all corporate, they handled family business. I mean, they took care of Seligman & Latz, the Seligman family, the Latz family. So it was that kind of old-fashioned relationship, business family. And the family at that point owned about 40% or so of the company. It was an American Stock Exchange company. So here again, I was fortunate. And I had a really, really outstanding mentor who's still practicing law today in his 80s, Klaus Eppler, who is well known to almost anybody who's been involved at the SEC. Klaus's practice was before the SEC. He knew everybody there. He certainly could have easily been appointed chairman or commissioner of the SEC. So he's well known. Klaus is a well-known, nationally well-known securities lawyer. And Klaus was the guy on our account for corporate stuff, not all the family stuff. So I worked with Klaus like an associate. And he put me through my paces. I'd be over at Proskauer till late at night, just like a first-year associate, second-year associate. And we were, right after I got there, the company, some of the family members wanted to cash in. And the Seligman family wanted to cash in more than the Latz Cuby family, so we had a secondary offering and went on the New York Stock Exchange. And so I have one of those, my sole big book. I have the document book for the secondary offering, and I was involved in it working with Klaus and associates at Proskauer hand in glove. So that was an unbelievable experience, you know, from beginning to end. So that was an enormous experience. And I was still, as you say, what was it like to be a general counsel? I was general counsel / associated prosecutor. And then I became more comfortable with the business of Seligman & Latz and the people of Seligman & Latz and the lawyers at Proskauer. We had lots of labor issues. So I worked with a lawyer named Howard Lichtenstein, who, if you're in the labor practice, Howard is since deceased, but he was kind of the dean of, kind of a almost a Ted Keel figure in New York labor law. And in fact, Howard had to approve me, not Klaus, but Howard Lichtenstein had to approve me before he was hired at Proskauer. Howard should have been a Supreme Court justice by appearance, or Chief Justice. He looked the part. He looked kind of like a combination of Warren Burger and Earl Warren. But a great friend of John Kuby's. They were not only business associates, pals. And we had big labor problems because we had Sullivan Lats had over 12,000 employees, and strange issues. They were hairdressers and operators of fine jewelry departments and department stores. So hairdressers are paid a certain way. It's a different kind of population, different kind of issues. And we, several of our operations were organized, including Bambergers. We ran all of Macy's beauty salons around the country, including Bambergers, which was part of Macy's. And Bambergers had a store-wide union, and it was the Teamsters. So our hairdressers were represented by the Teamster Union. And I learned my labor relations and labor negotiations at the hands of Howard Lichtenstein. And that was a very interesting negotiation with the Teamsters for our population of hairdressers. And so I was, again, fortunate in my training that I had this great securities lawyer that I worked with, and then this great labor lawyer that I worked with. And to make a long story short, I think I learned quickly and learned well and developed their confidence. And then I became what I would say was a true general counsel. And that was important to my career growth, as I'll describe it. Mm-hmm. But my goal then, and it was with Proskauer's agreement, was to reduce the amount of fees that we were paying Proskauer. And I did that. I think over the course of about 3 years, we reduced our fees by over $500,000. $500,000.
Fees for labor?
For both. Or? Both sides. Because I started doing all the SEC filings and the proxy statement and preparing for the annual meeting, which was modest for us, and all the labor negotiations and dealing with labor. So I would say then, and the business people at Seligman and Lats started coming to me directly. It had been an open door, and this is a problem for in-house counsel in a family business with the law firm that manages both the business and the family. Everybody, excuse me, everybody felt that they could pick up the phone and call Klaus or Howard. And we changed all that when there was confidence on both sides of the equation, and everything had to come through me so I could control what was going to outside counsel, and I could deal with what I knew I could deal with, and I could call outside counsel when I felt I needed them. So that led to a dramatic reduction in our fees, which was, you know, something that was good for me, for the company, and good for me career-wise.
You mentioned that you were in charge of the SEC filing and dealing with all the proxy matters. Can you talk a little bit about what this is, the mid-70s?
This is now, I started there, yes, this is mid, now going to late 70s, because the secondary offering was in 75, so we're getting into the mid to late 70s.
Can you talk a little about what it was like to file with the SEC and to deal with the proxy issues in the 70s?
For us, things were pretty routine. I can't remember whether it was a proxy statement issue or not. And I had a couple of times had occasion to call someone in the Division of Corporation Finance, but my interaction with the SEC was not that frequent or that involved. That came later in my career. But I will say, in terms of corporate governance and all the things that happened post-1970s, Seligman and Lats fit the model of probably everything that was troubling to investors about corporate governance.
How so?
The board was peopled with a family and friends of John Kuby. You were expected to vote the way John wanted you to vote. So it was a, you know, it was a board of family and friends. The road was not too bumpy, but because of it was a family dominated business still, even though it was public. But when I think back of some of the business problems that developed in terms of performance, particularly of the beauty salon division, I think that we might have fared better as a company with a board that was more appropriate, as we see boards today with outside directors. We had an outside director who was a professor at Harvard, and she was very direct, asked hard questions, and John didn't like that. And I think we had a classified board of, you know, 3-year terms for, I forget how many we had, and it was a bigger board than you'd see today. But the professor from Harvard was not asked to stand again for election. And then the next true outside director, they were never at really, she was really a true outside director. She was really a disinterested director. And then we put another woman on the board who was very prominent in retailing. And she did adhere to the company line. So we never had anybody on that board who asked the hard, tough questions. What management said was what it was.
Now, are you the corporate secretary at this point?
I'm corporate secretary as well. Yeah, my name's on the stock certificates. I signed secretary certificates, banking resolutions, took the minutes at the board meeting. But it was a very ministerial kind of job. I kept the records. It was a very different time. We had about 1,000 subsidiaries because we were taking advantage of the multiple surtax exemptions. So each beauty salon, we had 6,000 beauty salons. Each beauty salon, a cluster of beauty salons, was a separate corporation in a separate state. Mm. So I did all of the housekeeping for those corporations, and there was no software to do that. It was done by hand, and so that was part of my responsibility. And we had physical stock certificates for every one of those corporations, and we used to, our accounts were SD Leidesdorf, and which became Ernst & Ernst and then Ernst & Young. Okay. And so the founders of Seligman & Letts went back to Sam Leidesdorf, E.K. Latz, Sam Leidesdorf, and Judge Proskauer. I mean, that was how it all developed. And E.K. Latz, when I arrived, just a little story, E.K. Latz was still coming to work. He was 95. And he'd basically come to work to have lunch. Mm-hmm. And there was one guy, Bud Frohlich, since deceased, who was a senior account guy in the salon division. And Bud, I think, to have some companionship and to be nice to me, invited me to go to lunch with E.K. every day. So E.K. would come in around 10 o'clock, sort of putter around the office, stop in to see, ask people how things were going. And little story there, the used to be the IRS guys, they'd come in for, you know, like 6 months, and they'd sit in an empty office, and, you know, they'd be taking the lunch and everything. It was crazy, but it was standard. So EK's making his rounds. We call it Mahogany Row, and he drops in an office, and he says, "How are things going?" I think he's talking to an account exec of the company. It's an IRS guy. and he said something that disturbed EK. So EK went scurrying into John's office and said, "We should get rid of that guy. He's not a very loyal employee." But my job, so EK and Bud and I, we were in 666 Fifth Avenue, and there was a Stouffer's downstairs, and so we'd go down to lunch, the three of us. EK would have a martini and apple pie, and then go back upstairs and wait for Harvey, his chauffeur, to bring him home. But my assignment as a young lawyer there when they did the annual audit was to go across the street to a, I think it was a Citibank, maybe it was Chase, maybe Bankers Trust, doesn't matter. We had a a safe deposit box over there, and EK had his own personal box over mm-hmm. there. And so I was assigned to go over and count the stock certificates for all the subsidiaries, hundreds of stock certificates. And EK, it was EK's job to go over with me to sit while I did this. And it was he thought it was a big, important deal. This was his company. These uh-huh. were his stocks.
Right.
So I went over. The first time I did it was with a young guy from Leidesdorf. He didn't know what he was doing. I didn't know what I was doing. And EK's with us. We're in there, and we're opening up these envelopes and counting the stock, sealed envelopes and counting the stock certificates. And now we've been there about an hour, and EK's fidgeting because I guess he wants his martini. And he's saying, he calls me over and he says, David, I don't think this is right. And so I was sure it wasn't right, but I didn't know why it wasn't right.
Uh-huh.
So I said to the guy from Leidesdorf, hey, let's pack up and, you know, we'll take him to lunch and then I'll figure out how we're supposed to do this, which uh-huh. is what we did. Well, it turns out, which almost anybody listening to this would know, is that those seals, if they're not broken, you just take the 1,000 shares in the envelope and you say, okay, envelope, hey, we were opening them. And then on one of my visits to the safety deposit room, EK asked me to open up, get his own personal box.
Uh-huh.
And EK couldn't, he was almost blind at this point, 95-year-old right. man. And he asked me to read everything that was in his safety deposit box, from oh, wow. wills to letters. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my gosh. And some very personal stuff, but I did it.
Yeah.
And so that was my experience with EK and the safety deposit box.
It's kind of an interesting experience. You have a company that goes on the stock exchange right before the exchange does pretty significant corporate governance reforms.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like?
Well, I think I really became more aware of that when I got to the society, which
okay.
is there, so there's a break in time, and we were a small company, so it was kind of like the delay in 404 Sarbanes-Oxley applying to smaller companies. We were kind of left the way we were.
Okay.
We didn't get the attention, the corporate governance kind of attention that the larger companies were getting. So we kind of coasted along at Seligman Lats into the mid-80s
okay.
without feeling or taking recognition
okay.
Of what was going on and what they would soon face. I left in 85, Seligman and Lats, and even to the time I left, I would say they were just starting to focus on board structure.
Okay.
Board structure. And it was driven less, Robert, it was driven less by regulation and what was going on in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't largely institutionally held mm-hmm. either. So there weren't outside influences really compelling us to do things. I started to become aware of these things, and I was not a member of the society.
Mm-hmm.
Two lawyers before me, a fellow named Steve Dubin, was a member of the society. Then the person I replaced was not. I didn't even know the society existed. So I was not exposed to all the things that were going
okay.
on that the society would have been dealing with
okay.
at the time. So we were kind of in la-la land okay. in terms of corporate governance.
Okay.
So that would be, and that would be, I would venture to say, true of, you know, 5,000 companies. I mean, the biggies were getting attention and they were having problems. We weren't feeling it.
Okay.
Or addressing it.
So it wasn't. It just wasn't pressure on the small.
No pressure.
No.
Nope.
Okay.
I had an interesting situation. I went on the board of Seligman and Lats. So I was, you know, whatever discussions there might have been in the boardroom about what we should be doing or not doing, were really not related to that. We were starting to get ready to position ourselves to sell ourselves, and so there was a lot of You know, that took up a lot of the discussion at board meetings. But we didn't position ourselves so that we would look appropriate for a purchase in terms of our governance structure. We didn't, at least, even though it's on the board, it might have been happening at a different level than mine. But my interesting position on the board also was that I was the executor of Marion Cuby, John Cuby's wife's estate. Now, Marion Cuby was a Latz, so she was the ownership, not John Cuby. He married into the business, and I was the executor of Marion Cuby's estate, and she died, I guess, while I was a director or before. So I was voting. I was voting a controlling block of shares on the board. But again, I was not expected to exercise any independence in that role, although I did on one occasion vote against management. I couldn't control the vote, but it was about 15% of the vote, and I can tell you there was dead silence in the room when I cast my vote, and I indicated it was on the advice of counsel, which was in fact my own counsel. I was keeping my own counsel, but that made it even more dramatic.
Yeah.
So that was. But in terms of your real question, were we taking account of all that was starting to percolate and go on in the corporate governance arena? I would say no.
Okay. And so, at that point, you then went. Now, is the domestic salon division, is that still within?
That's within Seligman Latz. Okay. That was the original part of the business, started in 1910. The first beauty salon in the country was in H.S. Pogues in Cincinnati. E.K. Latz was a hair goods salesman, and Seligman was a notion salesman, and they used to travel. They both lived in Scarsdale. And they would get on the train and go across the country to and sell their wares to department stores. And old man Pogue asked him if they knew how to run a beauty salon. And as legend has it, or the story goes, E.K., who was the salesman, Robert Seligman was more the behind the scenes administrative guy. E.K. said, of course he knew how to run a beauty salon. So they get on the train coming back to New York, and so Seligman says to them, E.K., you don't know anything about running the beauty salon. You know, E.K., the eternal optimist, says, don't worry. And they ended up having a huge business, and they really made Clairol the company it was. The campaign Only Your Hairdresser Knows For Sure was all Seligman and Latz. All Seligman and Latz. QB was very friendly with the Gelbs, and I became friendly with the Gelbs. Gelbs ended up from running Clairol to running Bristol Myers, and Charlie Revson, and again, it's just a story, has nothing to do with your project, but Charlie Revson was having trouble making ends meet, and he came to E.K. Latz and asked Latz for money. And Latz apparently gave him $5,000, and Revson said, do you want a piece of my business? And E.K. said no. And, E.K., that was the one time he was not an optimist. And we had working for us Ira Siegel, who was in the 40s and 50s, was the highest paid female executive in the United States and a very well-known, you know, businesswoman. Mm-hmm. So it was a company with a lot of interesting stories behind it.
Did you have? Now there are some.
I would say in terms of the securities laws, and the one thing that I was very conscious of, and this is the Klaus training. We were very, very conscious of when we had to make public disclosure. I think we were. For our size company, and I think it was because of Klaus, we were very, very concerned about the family dealing in inside information. Mm. So that you know the the great purpose of the securities laws in terms of equal footing and disclosure was something that was drummed into me and drummed into the senior executives at Seligman Lats. And our control, we had stock option plan, the old kind, restricted stock, and I administered that. Mm-hmm. And this was before Section 16. Mm-hmm. But we had 144 stock, and we were very, very careful with trading in company stock and disclosure of events that maybe we always erred on the side of caution. So that was securities law, you know.
Did you ever, were takeovers or tender offers a concern?
Well, we had, and again, this was, even though I'd been there as general counsel and was now president of the Salon Division and on the board, Harold Janine, who eventually bought the company, came at the company twice, but it was not hostile.
Okay.
He came initially, he was interested in the fine jewelry business, Finley Fine Jewelry, and then, this is one of the reasons I left Seligman Lats, he came back again at the beauty salon business, and the beauty salon business is a cash cow, but low margin business, and there are no fixed costs. It's almost all variable. The rent to the stores is variable. The commissions to the operators are variable. So it's a low margin business, cash cow. So the cash cow fed the voracious appetite for cash that the fine jewelry business had with a very slow turning inventory. So it was a happy marriage. But Janine's idea was to buy Seligman and Lats and then buy our single competitor in the business, a company called Glenby, and combine the two, and he would have a monopoly in the department store beauty salon business. He'd have about 12,000 beauty salons. And his theory basically was he could control the wage costs, and also he could reduce the effective rent of, say, 18% to the stores down to, say, like 16%. And on a billion-dollar business, you know, they both become significant. Payroll was in excess of 50%. And he bought the business, and he bought Glenby. And but what happened was, during that stage, the second time he came back, I spent hours with Harold Janine, uncomfortable hours. His office was in the Waldorf Towers. And Janine had somehow gotten the notion that there were 15% margins in the salon business. And, I mean, it just, you could do the math all day long, and it wasn't possible, even with his scenario of, you know, if he could pull it off and if there weren't any trust problems. I don't know if Hart Rodina was in effect in those days, but, and maybe the share of the whole beauty salon marketplace was looked at rather than just department store where it would have been a monopoly. I think that's what happened. But he would not accept the fact that I couldn't show him 15% margins. And I had an old fashioned, which maybe today would be looked askance at. I had an old fashioned, you know, golden parachute deal. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't think I'd be happy with Janine nor he with me. And that's when I left Seligman and Lats.
And where did you go from Seligman and Lats?
From Seligman and Lats, I went to a company called Federated Linen and Uniform Services, which operates, it's a family business. So I had a look at the governance of a family business. Mm-hmm. So now I've seen a DLJ, I've seen Seligman and Lats, which fits the mold I've described. Now I'm with a family business started in the 1890s. In New York, if you're from New York, it's known as Cascade Linen, and they provided table linens and back-of-the-house garments for virtually every major restaurant in New York City. We had 300 trucks on the streets in New York, a huge plant in Brooklyn with 1,500 workers, all unionized. We had a big business in Texas, throughout Texas, and a business in California. And I went there I was general counsel, secretary, and kind of family lawyer all put together, consigliere kind of role. And they had a shareholders agreement, which was more important than any bylaws. So the shareholders agreement I kept in the next to my, right next in my right hand drawer mm-hmm. to find out what family member was entitled to what, because it was not a happy situation. And I ran the laundry business, the linen supply business in Texas and California. Okay. So that was a different experience. No, now there's no SEC.
Right.
It's just lawyering doing a lot of deals. The way that business grew is they buy small independent laundries all over the country. So I went around buying laundries and running the business in Texas and doing a lot of labor law.
Okay. And is it from there that you go to Confetti?
It's from there I go to Confetti. Okay.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Confetti, I want to tell you about it because I think it's interesting in terms of governance, even though it was governance and just the corporate world in general. I left Federated, Cascade, General Linen, all those names in 88, I guess. Should be on, let's see. Because I was with... Yeah, 87. I was with the laundry business from for 3 years, late 84 through 87. And I was uncomfortable with the linen supply business because the business is done with understandings with competitors, and General Linen was operating under a consent decree for antitrust problems they had in the 60s. And when I was there, we had some huge problems in Texas. This was a criminal antitrust investigation, and I spent about a year almost full time in Austin, Texas. And I myself was before the grand jury several times, and it's not a pleasant experience. And so, I decided this was not for me. It really wasn't the kind of law I wanted to practice. Mm-hmm. Being part of a family business that's at odds with one another is a nightmare. So, I decided to move on. And not sure what I was going to do, which was scary. I was at this point a little over 40 with now 5 children, a baby. So, you know, strange, difficult time. And I bumped into a friend of mine from high school, literally bumped into him. We had been very good friends in high school, had been friendly for a while, a guy named Dougie Krieger, who had owned a group of stores in New York called Krieger & Sons. And they were kind of like an Orvis. The most similar would be an Orvis kind of store, but it had its own sort of unique flavor to it. And very successful. And he had about 3 stores in New York and Westchester, and he branched off into Massachusetts. And then he sold it to a company called Amcina. And he was looking for something to do, and he wanted to do something in retail. And in fact, we made an office in Westchester. Dougie and myself and Frank Watson, who had been chairman of Lord & Taylor's, had left Lord & Taylor's, and he joined us. And we used to sit around with no salaries coming in, brainstorming about what we were going to do in the retail arena. And then... I don't know how Dougie came up with some idea for a magazine, which was going to be for members of PTAs around the country. And I said, Dougie, the magazine we've got to do is a magazine for customers in department store beauty salons. They're a captive audience. I know if we get Old Sullivan and Latz, Glenby, and there was one other player in the department store field, which was JCPenney, who ran their own salons. I said, if we can get a contract to provide all the reading material in those salons. We can go to advertisers with 10 million women a month coming through salons, mm-hmm. captive audience, in department stores. They spend an average of $100 in the store on the day of their salon visit. Beauty salons, because they have to be near plumbing, are put in the back of a store. And the idea, the original idea of beauty salons was to create traffic in the store. Women used to have a monthly wash and set, so they were coming in the store all the time. So if you go to any old store that still has a beauty salon, they're pretty much gone. Like Macy's in New York, be on the 10th floor in the corner, so the woman would have to go through the salon. So she's passing. So she goes to the beauty salon for a weekly visit. She feels good about herself. She's looked in the mirror after she's been fixed up, makeup, hair, and she walks to the store. She feels good about herself. She spends money. The demographics of the customer were great. So I convinced him, and he and I became founding partners. And then we brought in a woman named Denise Fletcher, who had been treasurer of the New York Times, and a guy named Maurice Bonham Carter, who is related to Helena Bonham Carter. Maurice had been a Morgan Stanley banker. And we started a magazine. And what was, you know, that's a whole day's story. But what is interesting about starting a company is that you, even though it was small and in the beginning, it's putting the pieces together of everything that ultimately becomes, you know, hopefully a Hearst or a Condé Nast, mm-hmm. Or in another industry becomes, you know, a Ford Motor Company or sure. an Apple. So you're not you don't have the SEC looking at you, but you're very conscious of putting the pieces together and how you're going to govern this mm-hmm. this thing. So and you do everything yourself. I mean, there's no department to turn to. Mm-hmm. You're the department. Right. You're the graphic arts department. Right. I mean, you may go for outside help. Mm-hmm. You're the PR department. You're the marketing department. You know, you're the benefits department. You hire people to do the magazine and do the artwork and everything. And then you, all of a sudden, at our peak, we had 30 employees. So all of a sudden, you're an employee. So now you have labor issues, and you have, how do you pay people? Do you give them stock that one day mm-hmm. they can cash in on? So I think the magazine experience was not a SEC experience, but in a way, my past background had me conscious of an overlay, not of regulation imposed, but a way to conduct oneself.
Sure.
It was not just seat of the pants. Mm-hmm. It was very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had an office in a brownstone, New York. We took out the garbage, the whole, you know, mm-hmm. We cleaned the bathrooms, sure. the whole bit. But the other elements of it were very much running a company. And we had first Boston on a full-time basis looking for a partner for us. So we had visions of getting venture capital money in or finding a strategic partner in a biggie like Hearst or Condé Nast, and we came close, but we didn't. But we certainly would have been dealing with exit strategy and stock and sure. stock. So, you know, we were hoping to end up that way. Mm-hmm. So that was the confetti experience, which I think it led to my going to the society, but it was very important to me in, I think, why they picked me for the society, interestingly enough, and my success at the society, which is or was, for me, a very entrepreneurial kind of situation.
So from confetti, you go to the society, what was then, I guess it was then just the Society of Corporate Secretaries.
It was the American Society of Corporate Secretaries. Right.
But not, no governance professionals yet.
No governance professionals yet. And our logo was an inkwell and pen, you know, an old quill pen. And we weren't even called ASCS in those days. It was the Society. it was, by the time I was there, there were some women, but very few. But if you went back 10 years before I came and you took a picture of the people at our national conference, mm-hmm. it was like, where's Waldo mm-hmm. to find a woman? So the organization was in the process of changing. And then from the 1990 when I got there through when I left in 2010 is when really my career followed the evolution of everything that was going on at the SEC and the exchange.
I was gonna say, can you give us a little background about what the Society of Corporate Secretaries, what it was up until 1990, and then just a little about what they do?
It was started in 1946. The idea had been floated before World War II and then tabled when everybody, you know, was preoccupied with the war. Then in 1945 or so, a group of four men got together. Reed Hartell was one. A guy named Ted Tierney. I could refer to our history that I told you about. Mm-hmm. And Tierney was, and they had this idea of a society of secretaries to deal with the business of being a corporate secretary more than governance issue. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, as everyone knows, a company has one corporate secretary, and in oftentimes it could be the chairman's executive secretary, mm-hmm. often a woman who knew, you know, where all the bodies were buried, yep. where all the documents were, was loyal to the chairman, loyal to his board of directors and so on. Very competent, just hadn't had the opportunity to go to college or law mm-hmm. school. So the corporate secretary position was initially, I think, very ministerial in a lot of ways, okay. green eye shade kind of thing. But Tierney was a proxy solicitor, and he saw a business opportunity because these were the guys who picked the solicitors, who picked the transfer agents and everything, the corporate secretary. And so he thought, let's form a group of these people. They have a lot of common interests, and you know, it'll also be good for me. So they started this thing in 1946, the Harvard Club in New York. That was not the first chapter. That's where it started. The first chapter of the society officially was the Chicago mm-hmm. chapter, and then New York, and then it grew from there. And the early chapters were St. Louis, where you're going to go, is an early chapter. New York, of course, Mid-Atlantic, which covered D.C. and Philadelphia. Southeast, and then the California chapters were early. LA, I think, was the first in 51, maybe, then San Francisco. And as the country grew and as corporations moved around, by the time I was there, there were 25 chapters around the country and about 2,800 members. But the original purpose was to help people similarly situated with nobody in their own corporations to tell them how you did things. So it was a very much relied on networking, and chapter meetings were very important. And most chapters had monthly meetings and it was important to people. I can remember Jack Gaich, who was secretary of a utility in Milwaukee, and became chairman of the society. Jack was not a lawyer, but Jack, Milwaukee and Chicago, there was one chapter, Chicago, and Jack for years would drive the 100 miles for the monthly meeting in Chicago because it was so important for him to be able to ask the secretary of Morton's or the secretary of the Chicago utility or the secretary of Walgreens or whatever, you know, what are you guys doing? Mm-hmm. Secretary Sears was an important member. You know, what do you do about this? You know, what do you do if you need a new director? I mean, do you go outside? Do you do it yourself? If you go outside, who do you use? Mm-hmm. Any issue that related to the board of directors dealing with the record keeping and dealing with the care. You heard when I first started, the secretary was involved with the care and feeding of the directors. Mm-hmm. So you arranged, if there was an offsite, mm-hmm. you were arranging, you made sure the coffee was there, you made sure mm-hmm. the wives were included, that there was something for the wives to do. You made sure the bus got to the place at the right place and was there when the directors came out of the hotel. And there were the war stories that used to be told when I first started at national conferences were like that, you know. There were stories of a bus not being there, and, you know, oh my God, what are we going to do, you know. Or going on an offsite and somebody all of a sudden wanting a separate meal. Right. And so that was corporate secretary, you know, this person doesn't eat steak. I thought we told you that, right. You know, kind of thing. So it was a combination of a specific job function, mm-hmm. Which was kind of ministerial and somewhat clerical. It was often being the confidant of the CEO because you would often be traveling with the CEO. And it was in a way, a heady job also. It was an interesting combination of being subservient and dutiful and cooperative and making sure, you know, nothing went wrong, but being able to fly on the corporate jet with the chairman, you know, and mm-hmm. go over what he was going to say at the annual meeting or what he was going to do if someone got up and threw a rotten tomato at him, that kind of thing.
Now, are people doing this in conjunction? Is this an independent position or are people doing this in conjunction with another job?
Mostly in conjunction with another job. And also, by the time I got there, most of the people who were corporate secretaries were lawyers, mm-hmm. and lawyers who had gone to really had good educations, and it was an important job. I don't want to in any way diminish the importance of it. There was this aspect of always making sure, and even in any job, there's that, you know, you worry that everything's going to be done properly, but mm-hmm. the worry fell directly on the shoulders. And you were very visible because you were doing things that were for the chairman. And if it was not done, you know, A number one, perfect, you know, it's kind of thing. If it's done well, nobody, you get no recognition. But right. Boy, if something goes wrong, you're really in a bad way. So, but you were subservient to the chairman's needs. You did have your very important specific responsibility. You were sort of the keeper of the corporation's books, records, history. You were it. You often had an HR position in as well. You often were maybe in charge of the company's charity, which was the chairman's favorite thing. And as the company got more involved in the complications of being a public company and disclosure, and if you were a big company, you had a lot to do with the SEC and disclosure. And again, you had to understand the listing agreement. What were the requirements of the listing agreement? What were the triggers in your bank agreement that would cause problems, disclosure problems? And so as the complexity of being a public company grew, the responsibilities of the corporate secretary grew as well, along with them.
So when you got to the society in 1990, what are sort of the major issues at that point?
I would say, now, if I were to characterize it in terms of the SEC and governance, I kind of look at it, I've thought about it, I looked at it this way. Breeden was chairman of the SEC. And Breeden, I got exposed to, I wouldn't say I got to know him. And he was, I think, sort of midterm. And Linda Quinn was head of the Division of Corporation Finance, I believe. And she, my impression when we were down at the SEC, if Breeden was at a meeting, Linda was right there. I'm not drawing any conclusions. It just seemed that was mm-hmm. a very, you know, important close working relationship, the chairman and the head of the division, which mm-hmm. I think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think Breeden's a little younger than I am. I think he was born in I was born in 45. I think Breeden was born in 48, 49. Mm-hmm. And I mention that because he's now in his late 60s. But he grew up, was a lawyer, went to school, was a lawyer, and had the experiences that I've described were mine mm-hmm. out of law school in the 70s. He would have had parallel experiences in whatever he was doing at a law mm-hmm. firm. So he grew up and matured professionally during a period where really the model was management and the board were close. Mm-hmm. Shareholders were investors. They didn't question things. It was all the sort of bad things that institutional investors and others who care about corporate governance have come to deal with, criticize, and try to correct. So I think as I look at my own career starting in the 90s and the people I dealt with at the SEC, I see a kind of evolution that I think is interesting. And if you look at it chronologically a little bit, you have Breeden, as I've just described. Mm-hmm. And then he was followed by Arthur Levitt. Mm-hmm. And I consider Breeden was kind of a traditional gatekeeper kind of guy, mm-hmm. I think, I would say.
In what sense?
The status quo, more or less, the really attack on corporations and what they were doing was just, I think, beginning.
What do you mean? What do you mean? The attack on corporations?
Well, you didn't have a powerful Council of Institutional Investors.
Okay.
You didn't have an ISS.
Mm-hmm.
You had gadflies still. Mm-hmm. You had that the woman and the Gilberts, Evelyn Davis, and the Gilberts,
mm-hmm.
and you had the more serious. you started to have the more serious, the Icons and the Nell Minows. And Bob Monks.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the infancy of it, as I see it. So I see Breeden as kind of in the mold of the former SEC's chairman. Then Levitt comes in with a background in business and a background at the American Stock Exchange. And I would say that he took a kind of practical approach to he saw a need, and he saw a need in terms of disclosure. He saw a big need, and he initiated the Plain English Initiative, mm-hmm. which was, I think, his major undertaking.
Can you tell me a little about the Plain English Initiative?
Well, I think quite simply, Levitt felt that the documents that were given to shareholders were filled with legalese. They were very difficult to read, and I guess there was a movement in other areas to make things understandable to everybody, whether it was a lease agreement or a bank loan agreement. But he certainly wanted the SEC documents, particularly the proxy statement or an offering statement, to be clear and understandable, so the average person knew what was being disclosed, why it was being disclosed, and why it was important to them, in plain, simple subject verb kind of language.
Was there an impetus to him pushing that, or is it just something he thought needed to be done?
I think he was the impetus. I mean, I think, and you know, it was the reaction was interesting because initially, I think my impression was that a lot of lawyers didn't like the initiative, and they thought that it stripped away some protective language that they were used to. Also, they had learned it the way their teachers had taught them. I mean, you go to a major law firm, and they have a way of writing documents, and you follow that mm-hmm. pattern. And I think Levitt felt it was more obfuscation than clarity. So he made a big push. He had Nancy Smith. He hired a woman. I don't think she was a lawyer, but her passion, her goal, her charge was to see that Plain Ingers got put in place. And we were very involved in that. The first major corporate document, I think, that was done in Plain Ingers was done by Kathy Gibson when she worked for a Bell company, and they merged. But this would have been back in whenever Levitt was chairman, and that was a major plus for what he was trying to do, and sort of a major accomplishment for the society, because we worked hand in glove with him and Nancy Smith on that document.
Well, that would have been a big change for corporate secretaries.
Huge.
Okay.
And lawyers. They are lawyers, but the lawyers in private practice as well. Big change.
What are some of the other things that you remember from Arthur Levitt's tenure?
That's really the thing that sticks most in my mind, is his Plain English initiative.
Did the society deal much with the auditor independence rules that he pushed? And
not as much. I think that really fell more to the financial side of the company, the CFOs.
Okay.
Not as much at all.
So, what are some of the other things the society? The shareholder access is a big deal in the 90s, but what are some of the things that the society is dealing with, or is it more sort of issues specific to corporate secretaries?
Well, I think the issues that I think of that we got very involved in, and perhaps are still involved in, certainly proxy access, very involved in that whole dialogue discussion, and what were going to be the thresholds for access to the proxy statement. Was 3%, 5%, mm-hmm. What kind of groupings could you have? I know we wrote comment letters. We were always in discussion with the SEC about what was the right balance, mm-hmm. there. I know that they have not appealed the Court of Appeals decision in that. There's private ordering now. And I think also the internet and so many issues has changed the landscape incredibly, certainly in terms of communications and disclosure. So we were very involved in that. We were never, and I'll pick out some things that may not or may be significant. We were never very involved in 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley. I say that with some reservations. We did take a stand. Well, the society, it can be said, and maybe critically said, that we were more a big company organization.
Okay.
Okay, mm-hmm. New York Stock Exchange kind of companies. So during my tenure, and I'm not saying it was me, but during mm-hmm. the time I was there, we became very conscious of a need to service a constituency that really needed us, maybe more than the big guys, and that was the smaller issuers, the NASDAQ companies. We never made the kind of inroads in terms of membership that I wanted to with them. I mean, we had about 500-600 members, and we had a lot of turnover there, and there are reasons for that too. But so we did take a stand on the 404, and we wanted the impact for it to be effective on small companies, if at all, delayed. So we were on the side of the small issuers on that one.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of other governance issues, the leadership structure of the board. Certainly involved in the discussions of director tenure, director retirement, the splitting of the chairman and the CEO. I think our position was a proper one, because I think it's a gray area in many cases and situations, circumstances alter situations. So I think our general posture and I'm not saying we really ducked the issue, but often, you know, one size doesn't fit all,
right.
Which became almost cliched. But it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It is true to have, and I think that's one of the issues with regulation in general, and I'm not opposed to regulation. That's not what I'm saying. But you are creating a paradigm where it's inclined to be one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can carve out some exceptions, but I think we were very conscious because of the variety of companies that we had in our membership. I think that's something we really were of value to the SEC. Nobody represented more companies before them than we did. I mean, we had like 2,700 public companies mm-hmm. represented in our membership, and big and small. I mean, mostly big, but there's no other organization that I know of that had the breadth and scope of membership that was involved in the plumbing, the nuts and bolts of how corporations dealt in the board of directors. So I think our opinion. That's why I think our opinion was highly valued, and it was always tempered by an understanding that different companies and different situations require different solutions, or may require different solutions. So I think that in broad strokes, I think our value was that we could relate to specifics, but we also could caution that you can't take any one situation and apply a standard that will cover everybody. So I think that the whole issue of board structure, mm-hmm. board accountability, what gets in front of the board, those are still issues that they deal with. How is the board addressing risk? How are they addressing, you know, the standard stuff? Sure. How are they addressing succession planning?
Right.
What do they do? I mean, I think it's interesting that recently, as I read in the papers, there have been several boards where the directors have not gotten majority votes. One, I think, a whole board. I can't tell you which one. A whole board was not reelected by majority, and they all met. Okay, so they're all just sitting there. They all got 40%. So they meet as a board to fulfill their fiduciary responsibility in the face of this vote, because they're supposed to, under their bylaws, tender their resignation. So all of the directors tender their resignation, meet to decide whether they will accept the resignations, and of course don't. So that's the extreme example of yeah. You know, in a comment letter, we might say, what would happen if, you know, mm-hmm. someone would say, well, that's not going to happen, right. But it happened. It seems to me that's an important issue today, and I'm sure, I know it is, but why isn't it, and I could be, again, you know, it's a couple of years, it seems to me that if a director doesn't get a majority vote, and he or she is to tender his or her resignation to the board, it seems to me if the board decides that this director deserves to stay on, that they're valuable in a way that nobody understands, there ought to have to be an explanation, mm-hmm. sure. a public explanation. It can be a page mm-hmm. of why they have made that decision. And I think that explanation also ought to be prominent, either under the director's name or it ought to be in the proxy statement next time they run as to why they retain that person. But it ought to be prominent on the website so an investor could say, okay, they kept Ms. XYZ even though she got 30% because.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that has happened. I'm not aware that there's a clamoring for it. But that to me would be the kind of issue that our members would think about, might suggest. And I think what we tried to become, at least I hoped we tried to become, is a little more proactive that way mm-hmm. rather than reactive. we never wanted to be always negative, you know?
Right.
That's easy. And, you know, we had a different role from the BRT or others who were very, very pro corporation. our inclination was that, you know, you can't take a few bad apples and punish the whole world for it. So I would say that was definitely our position. You know, don't regulate because of a few bad apples. But I think we had a very measured, thoughtful approach to things. But I think the issue I just described to you is one that I would urge is an intelligent, proper thing to do. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it's already in the work. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not there. But it seems to me that would be the kind of thing if I were organizing a presentation for the SEC, I would say, hey, why isn't this going to be a solution that will solve a lot of problems mm-hmm. for everybody involved? Mm-hmm. And if you can't write a paragraph as to why you kept that person, well, maybe you better rethink your vote. You know?
So you talked about representing companies before the SEC. How does the society do that?
We have a committee. Well, the society has several committees that do serious work, very responsible work. And one, the one that deals with the SEC, is the Securities Law Committee. And the people that you are going to be meeting with that I suggested, Hank Barnett and Carl Barnacle, were not only corporate secretaries and general counsels of major companies, they both were chairman of the Securities Law Committee of the society. And that's sort of the three major committees of securities law, securities industry, which is called something else now, but it's securities industry, and that dealt more with the your listing requirements. So they would interact with the exchanges, and they would deal with issues, more mechanical issues like ISS and those.
Is that public company committee? Is it the public company?
That's the Public Company Affairs Committee now. Right. That's right. That's right. And what's the third one? Anyway, I sound like that guy from Texas in his debate. He's going to eliminate three public company affairs, securities law, and corporate practices.
Yes.
And corporate practice is much more the nuts and bolts of being a corporate secretary. How you take minutes, how you prepare for the annual meeting, how you select a solicitor, how you select a transfer agent, how do you know if they're doing the right thing, what are the rules for abandoned property, and on and on. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's corporate practices, public company affairs, and securities. Securities law is the one that always dealt with the SEC. So what was the question?
Well, so how does it do that? Is it mostly personal relationships?
Okay, it's a combination of things. On its own, it's charged with keeping abreast of all the things that are happening at the SEC that are of importance to us. Mm-hmm. And they have at least quarterly meetings. Their meetings are usually around major events, whether it's a national conference or a major fall conference or a board meeting or our annual meeting. So there's an opportunity to spread their thinking throughout the organization. So, but they are following closely. I mean, something like SOX comes up, Sarbanes-Oxley, or Dodd-Frank, or they're awaiting what the rules on proxy access. I mean, mm-hmm. we're like the law firms. We're waiting with bated breath, you know, and then it comes out. The 10 members of that committee are pouring through it point by point, and they come out with a summary. Now, that's an interesting thing in terms of the society's history. We used to be the only source of that stuff for our members. When I first came, we were in. Mm-hmm. First of all, the law firms did memos, but they were very, very... They were their members. They went to their clients. In fact, we were scared to take any memo from a law firm that got in somebody's hands as a client of the law firm. Let's say Chevron gets a memo mm-hmm. and distributed to our members. We would go to the law firm, you know, whether it was Wilson Sons, whoever it was, and say, can we give this to our members? So law firms start to change. Yeah. The environment, the economics of the law firm. Now, all of a sudden, midway through my term as chairman of the president and CEO of the society, mm-hmm. they're begging us to take it. Yeah. We get 10 memos. I come to my office in the morning, something's come out that afternoon. Obviously, the associates at every major law firm have stayed up overnight mm-hmm. to write a memo on a Section 16 change, a crowdfunding memo, mm-hmm. anything you can think of, and I get ten of them.
Right. Now it's a way to drum up business.
It's a way to drum up. It's marketing.
Right.
But it didn't obviate the need for our committee because we looked at it with our own perspective. So, okay, so the Securities Law Committee is on top of everything that's coming down that relates to what our members need to do their jobs more effectively. Then they have meetings to prepare. We have publications. We have programs. It's decided we need a seminar on such and such a subject, or we need a conference call meeting on such and such a subject. So it's organizing ourselves by publications, by events, by programming to convey this to our members. Then we have this regular, periodic, formal dialogue with the SEC in person.
Mm-hmm.
And in between time, we have developed enough relationships in the SEC, whether it's a market reg issue, an enforcement issue, as I said, most often a corporate fin issue, to call up, you know, whoever's the person handling the matter, whether it's, you know, Brian Lane before he was head of the corp fin, he was a go-to guy, mm-hmm. or Marty Dunn, or Elise Walter. You know, it could be all the names you know and will come to, or do know, and your father knows. We would have the ability to pick up the phone and they would answer us, you know, up to the chairman. So we had that access because of, during our meetings and our comment letter process, we were viewed as somebody who was thoughtful and helpful to the process. So that interaction was both informal and very formal in terms of these two meetings a year, where we prepared, the agenda was done in conjunction with someone at the SEC. It was often in later years, Maury Osheroff would sort of be the focal point for us, and the chairman of the Securities and Law Committee, and Maury and the chairman, they'd figure out what were the topics, mm-hmm. who should be there, who was going to speak, for how long, and so it was as if we were testifying before a congressional okay. committee. So it was very formal. And then the informal stuff afterwards that I described, whether it was a reception or a dinner or a gathering, there would be the discussion would continue. And it was an opportunity to really get a little more into the weeds with somebody, or to find out when do you think this is going to come out? When should we be looking for rulemaking on such and such?
Excuse me.
So it was on multi levels. There was very constant contact with the SEC and its personnel. And I can tell you, I don't know, 10, 15 former heads of the Division of Corporation Finance are members of the society. Ed Fleischman's a member of the society, long-term former commissioner. I think Roberts was for a while. Virtually everybody, all these people that I've known since 1990, they've all spoken at various conferences, chapter meetings. So the back and forth and the contact is constant with them. And the same for other issues with the exchanges. Much more so during, I think, the Phelan, Grasso, Donaldson era at the New York Stock Exchange than recently, because the personalities have changed, the issues have changed, they've changed, we've changed. You know, it's just different. But I think this important relation and it's been a long, long, long relationship going back. You know, when you start in 1946, the SEC hadn't been around but 13 years. It was an infant.
Yeah. Who are some of the personalities with whom the society has worked pretty closely or worked well with?
Well, a lot of personalities. I would say... In his short tenure, Harvey Pitt, and Harvey was well known to lots of us when he was a Fried Frank lawyer, because he was on a lot of panels, and then he became chairman, and it was it was kind of short-lived for lots of reasons, as you recall. But we knew Harvey well, and he was a good guy. And time out. Bathroom.
All right, we're back on.
Okay. In terms of my own personal relationships with people, as I mentioned, Harvey Pitt was someone that a lot of us knew pretty well when he became chairman, because he had spoken mm-hmm. for us many times when he was a lawyer in private practice. I would say Steve Wallman, as a commissioner, was very interested in working with the society, and he had a very important view, I think, that way too much time, effort, and capital was spent on 33 Act registrations, and not enough to the ongoing disclosure under the 34 Act. And I think he thought that, and I can't put words in his mouth, but I just think he thought that was something that should be focused on and streamlined and made more nimble than it was. And then after he left the SEC, he started his own business, and he tried to compete. I think he sold it, but he tried to compete with GMI and ISS in the proxy advisory business. And he and I talked a lot about that, and he talked to the society about that. So we had the relationship mm-hmm. when he was at the SEC yeah. and then following.
Okay.
Mary Shapiro, a long time spokeswoman at society events, and then I was not at the society during most of her time as chairwoman, but all throughout her career, when she was a commissioner, when she was at FINRA, we did deal with FINRA at but again, that was more for the accountant side of things. But we would occasionally, because we had members who were accountants as well as lawyers, we did get involved in some auditing type mm-hmm. accounting issues, but not, it was kind of rare
okay.
and sort of tangential to our main purpose. So, again, I said Breeden was sort of, I think, you know, the represented it, kind of the status quo gatekeeper, I think is very interesting. The appointment of Mary Jo White, who kind of brings us, I mean, if you follow, and you could ask, you know, maybe Hank and Carl this question, if you follow the chairman they have known and sort of the character of the SEC throughout the outside events that have taken place, I think you'll see sort of a parallel from sort of not benign neglect, I won't go that far, but sort of a traditional kind of role to a more activist role to now a real, I take it, a very serious oversight role. Movement more towards, obviously, towards enforcement,
mm-hmm.
or that's the perception.
Sure.
And of course, we it's interesting, Mary Jo, because she spoke before the society on a couple of occasions, not as a securities lawyer, but more, one of the concerns about it became a concern. Particularly after the Disney case, was minutes. Minutes is the bread and butter of being a corporate secretary, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But is it short form? Is it long form? How much do you say? And here is where you find amazing needs on the part of smaller companies. And I used to do a a breakout group when we did the public company sessions at the national conference or the issues update seminar. I would cover the private and not for profit companies, and we'd maybe get 20-30 people because they weren't into the issues at the SEC, and I had been at the Cascade, the family business, and the small public company. And the issue of what you put in minutes, how you write minutes, when can you change me? Can my chairman wants to change, this resolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, and people who had a tape recorder, like you have for this interview, recording everything that went on at the meeting, should I do that? I mean, hundreds of questions about taking minutes. But long way of saying, we once had a guy named Charlie Stillman, who's a white-collar criminal lawyer in New York City, former U.S. attorney, about 75 now, but he's defended, people like Clark Cliff, big, he defended some people in Enron and WorldCom. And I asked Charlie to come speak to us. I'm friendly with Charlie. And his whole message was, there's real serious liability that people can go to jail, depending upon what you put in the minutes or don't put in the minutes. It's become a very, very serious document.
Liability for the secretary or for the director or both?
For the director, okay. For the director and the company.
Okay.
More for the directors. And Mary Jo came and sort of talked in the same vein, not just minute, but, all the things that can get people in trouble. With the securities laws. So that's how I know Mary Jo. And, of course, we knew John White when he was head of the Division of Corporation Finance. And this, you may not want this for this, but it's interesting. Mary Jo, I was home watching television when she came out with Obama and he was announcing her appointment. And I had her email address, and I knew her because of her speaking at the society, and I knew her husband very well. So I wrote her an email. I said, congratulations, this is great, or something, just that David's. But I didn't even think she'd get it. 20 minutes later, I mean, she's there on television. 20 minutes later, I get a response saying, David, thanks very
that's
much.
Wild.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's amazing. I mean, it says something amazing about her. I mean, I just did it almost just as a courtesy. I mean, I didn't even think she'd remember me. Mm-hmm. And maybe she didn't, but the fact that she's so on top of everything is remarkable. And then I actually had breakfast with John a couple of weeks ago, and he was describing, because she had been considered for head of the FBI, and she's on some Guantanamo committee. So he said what she's been through already in terms of security clearances and, what she has for breakfast and where her kids went to school and who they hung out with. He says it's incredible what you go through to have one of these positions. So I think her appointment is very interesting, and we'll see what it means.
If I could jump backwards a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
So why does the society go from Society of Corporate Secretaries to Corporate Secretaries and Governance Professionals?
Okay. In January of 1996, we had taken our kids skiing to a not an overnight skiing, a day skiing trip. Up near Poughkeepsie, so there's some mountains, and I don't ski, so they were all out skiing, and I'm sitting in the lodge, and I'm reading the New York Times, and there's an article in the Business Sunday's Times. So there's an article in the business section about companies creating the position of CIO, Chief Information Officer, and it describes who that is and why there's a need for it, and all the information that comes in and goes out, and someone has to kind of sort through it and filter it and be the gatekeeper and so on. I guess that's it. And so the corporate governance has been around as a concept for a long time, but I was becoming concerned with all that was happening in corporate governance that the society and our members would be left out, that someone else would grab hold of that, either a new association or NERI or NACD, and we would lose membership, we would lose standing. And I also thought that, and I was always very conscious of this, fairly or unfairly, that this role that our members, by virtue of their jobs and almost their personality as a very diplomatic people, because they had to be in the kind of position they were in, they weren't aggressive mm-hmm. for their own careers, which is why if you're at a gathering of corporate secretaries, all of whom are lawyers, it's a wonderful experience because they're nice people generally. They're really great people. And they're very smart, but they're accommodating. They have this role that we understand. So I thought, look, these people may not fight for their careers. As a general rule, I don't want someone else swooping in and taking over this field. Mm-hmm. So I write an article in our own publication, February 1996, and I call for the creation of a CGO, Chief Governance Officer. And I probably have it bronzed somewhere. And there are few people who remember that. And I was the first. I will say this with no reservation. And I called for this, and it fell pretty much on deaf ears. And I got Rich Kopis a couple of years down the road to kind of join me in this notion that there ought to be a... And he wasn't sure whether it should be the corporate secretary or a separate person or whether it mattered. I mean, what's in a name kind of thing. But I thought it was a lot that was important in the name. And so he and I did an article together. And then the thing started to grow, and a couple of people caught on to it, and they went to their chairman and said, I want to be the chief governance officer. So it grew. And now I think it's fairly common. And the name change didn't happen because of that. But that's how I was thinking. And then the society, as the leadership of the society, started thinking not so much about changing their titles or changing their upward mobility in the corporation, which was sort of what I had been thinking about, but that we needed a name that better reflected what people did, that they were doing this in fact, and it ought to be part of our moniker, our umbrella. And so we struggled with what we should be called. It pretty much divided, I would say, about 50-50. Maybe not. I would say, if I'm saying it to you now, I would say most people wanted to keep our name. It had been around now for 50 years. We were the society. We were the ASCS. We had created a tagline after my article, Excellence in Corporate Governance. So it was the American Society of Corporate Secretaries, Excellence in Corporate Governance. Then we were ASCS, Excellence in Corporate Governance. And we did get rid of the inkwell and quill mm-hmm. as a logo. A lot of people didn't like that. A lot of people. That one was age specific.
Okay.
Age specific. And all of a sudden people, you know, there was somewhat of a sensitivity always among the men in the organization with the title corporate secretary. All of a sudden it became a badge of honor to be a corporate. What are we doing away with the pen and quill for? What's wrong with being a corporate secretary? We have Secretary of State, Secretary of War. It's an honored Secretary of the General Assembly of the UN, which mm-hmm. is all true.
Right.
It's a very ennobling, important designation. But it used to be, you know, you're at a dinner party, what do you do? I'm secretary of Coca-Cola. Oh, you know, you get coffee? I mean, do you take Steno? You know, mm-hmm. sometimes jokey, sometimes not. And when I got this job, you know, and people in the know, like Klaus Epler, right away said, oh my gosh, David, that's a great organization, you know. But I'd be at some dinner party in Scarsdale and say, what are you doing? You know, I run the corporate secretaries, you know. What's that? You know, they would assume it was a secretary stenographer.
Sure.
So anyway, that's a little bit of an aside, but all of a sudden with the name change, it became, people became really wedded to being corporate secretary. So it really divided along age lines on that. But the younger folks and you know, they had a prominent voice in what was said, and it did make some sense. So we became the Society of Corporate Secretaries and Governance Professionals. We dropped the American. Some people thought there was significance in that we were going international. There was no such thought at all. I mean, we have some international members, but no. So it was to add the governance part. And then I understand that recently they thought it was cumbersome, which I always thought it was cumbersome. And then we had a very long, when you went on the internet, you know, our address was long and cumbersome.
Sure.
And somebody said, well, that's good. And somebody said it wasn't. So there was a lot of debate about it.
Yeah.
But they settled on that. And I think it's a good name, by and large. You know, people are used to it now. It does say something important about what our members do. I mean, they really are involved in this arena of corporate governance. And they are professionals, and so I think it's a good name.
Did it come at all out of the sort of expanded responsibilities out of Sarbanes-Oxley?
Yes. I think that's a point I should have made to you, because the timing, I think it was pretty coincidental with that, and I think that was a big impetus for it. Yes.
Could you just give what sort of new responsibilities came out of that legislation?
I'm trying to think of all the provisions as distinguished between. I think because it focused a lot on, I think of 404, but it focused a lot on the structure of the board and having, I mean, really, really companies strained to figure out, first of all, the definition of financial expert, who was and who wasn't. And then the issue of independence, what's an independent director, what's a financial expert, those definitional questions, which were trying to be sorted out and interpreted from Sarbanes, and there had to be interpretive releases and stuff. That was a major, major issue. And companies became focused in terms of their board structure and dealing, and the search firms, the executive search firm, board search firms, that became a preoccupation, was how they would people the audit committee and who was going to be the financial expert.
There was a shortage of governors.
And there was, absolutely. That's another major issue as general that I see going forward. Is still peopling the board, not only the board in general, but the special committees of the board, and finding people of time, and finding diversity, and finding anyway. But yes, that was a huge issue. And at the same time, I was also touting with search firms that they should put corporate secretaries on boards of directors, because who knew the inside and outside the boardroom better? And I thought this was another thing of promoting my membership. And I got in front of some big search firms, Spencer Stuart and Heidrick and Korn Ferry, and they all bought into the idea. Although their one skepticism was, is the CEO going to let them do it, time wise and so on? But they said, our attention right now, David, and for the foreseeable future, is the audit committee and finding financial experts for companies. He said, that's all we're doing. That's all we're doing right now. Your question brings that back to mind. So we were involved very much in the discussion of the definitions and who was, and also very involved. And I think it came out of SOX too. Is the Perquisites, using director pay and what had to be disclosed, mm-hmm. and a whole thing about traveling on corporate aircraft. I mean, this took on huge. I mean, we talked about it, I think, two or three times, made presentations at the SEC on how you calculated if a director was going anyway to Paris and his wife went with him. Uh-huh. You know, was that how was it? What was the increment that you?
Do you have to disclose? And
what do you disclose if, what's the value if there's, the company has a parking lot and the CEO has a separate spot inside lot and so on? I mean, it got to that point. It really got to that point. Is an executive bathroom, I'm serious, is that a perquisite? You know, you get a $10,000 executive bathroom built. Do the shareholders have to know that your CEO has that? And then, of course, along comes some guy who spent, not too long ago, spent something like $300,000 on his office. I forget which company, or, you know, it wasn't a major player, mm-hmm. but it made the press.
Right.
So, Sarbanes-Oxley brought into focus, the whole Enron thing, that brought into focus all of this stuff. And we were involved in it up to our eyeballs. That's right. What is a perk? How do you value the perk? How do we get a financial expert? Do we have one already on the board? Is he independent? Is she independent? Her son goes, and there was something about there was a case about somebody whose kid went to the same prep school, and the question was: is that person independent? You know, both their kids go to Deerfield or something, and they go to his football game. They both play football. Mm-hmm. Is that guy, and he's a partner at Pete Marwick. Is he an independent can be on my audit committee? So that was the way it was. And the sensitivity, you know, it's like after a terrorist attack. Everybody's looking at every backpack in the world thinking there's a bomb in it. The sensitivity after Enron and WorldCom, and then the Sarbanes-Oxley comes along. Nothing was too ridiculous to mm-hmm. consider.
Well, you also have the exchange is putting in the new regulations.
Right. And a big deal that our members got involved, now this isn't securities law, this is more public company affairs, was the 452 stuff at the stock exchange and the broker discretionary vote. Mm-hmm. And we spent many, many hours on many committees at the New York Stock Exchange dealing, and many of us were on committees dealing with the fees that ADP charged for proxy distribution, the proxy fee discussion. I was on several committees. We went through that thing. And if they suppress mailings, what kind of fee should they get? And that's still, I mean, but the broker non-vote was a huge issue. We were very involved in that. I think it was absolutely essential that the election of directors be taken away. It's not a routine vote. Mm-hmm. And that was the big deal. Because if directors were routine votes and you had an election for directors and approving auditors, the street voted, and they voted 99% for management. That was the issue. Mm-hmm. And so they took away the broker discretionary vote for directors, and you had to get votes from everybody. So that was of course, the proxy solicitors loved that. That mm-hmm. was in the early, when was that? That was
mid-2000s?
Mid-2000s. Yeah. That's when I think Kathy Kinney was president of New York Stock Exchange. It was after, started with Grasso. Mm-hmm. It was between.
I think it's 2004 or 2005.
That would be right. That would be about right. I still think a major issue that nobody seems to want to touch, although they still waltz around it, is the undue influence of ISS, mm-hmm. the intermediaries. And I think the fact that ADP, now Broadridge, is basically the sole distributor of proxy materials is a problem. I think it puts it. It's just a problem.
It's been people have been talking about it more. The sort of the conflict of interest where you have to you get a score on your corporate governance, then you have to go to the same people to tell you how to fix it.
Well, I'll tell you a little story about that. When I first started at the society, ISS operated basically out of a one-room office in Bethesda, Maryland. Nell Minow and Monks had left, and Jamie Hurd was running it. And Jamie, we had a guy in Washington, a member, Jerry Breslow, who was a corporate secretary of ComSat. And we never had a lobbyist in Washington, and we don't lobby. We advocate, don't lobby. We're not a lobbyist. We don't register as lobbyists. We don't attribute dues to lobbying. But Jerry was our eyes and ears in Washington. He was secretary of ComSat, and they were involved. The reason for Jerry, he's in Washington, and ComSat had three congressionally appointed directors or something. It's like a quasi public utility kind of thing. They put in satellite communication.
Yeah.
So Jerry was our eyes and ears in Washington. So I'm there at the society in a minute, and Jerry says, Jamie Hurd wants to meet with us. So I go down, we go to Chevy Chase, and Jamie, who I got to know pretty well, and he spoke to us many times. So Jamie says to us, and I barely understand what they do at this point, but he says, I understand enough to know that he's going to do something that I think is not going to work.
Uh-huh.
He says, because they're making the recommendations, but he said, and this was when the stock plans were everybody was having stock plans, and they were getting shareholders weren't approving stock plans, and so
executive stock plans,
yeah, okay, yes, and so ISS and Jamie Hurd had this black box, and that's what it was called, the black box, and they put your plan into the black box, and if it came out one way, they said the shareholders should vote for it. If it came out another way, they said they should vote against it. And sometimes identical stock plans for subsidiaries of the same company would come out differently. So it was, you know,
Black box being like a computer program or something?
Just figuratively,
okay.
I think.
Oh, okay.
It may have been people with check sheets or something.
Sure. Okay.
And then was it black? How did you value them for disclosure purposes? Uh-huh. Black Scholes? Was it some other way?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, Jamie, and it was critical to companies and critical to corporate secretaries, because if you had a stock plan and you get your proxy statement out, you spend millions of dollars on it, you've got all kinds of people poised to get these stock grants, and you then go to your shareholders and you get turned down, it's a disaster on many levels. And who would be looked at as having blown it? It was the corporate secretary. And the chairman would ask, is our plan going to get approved? And they were supposed to go to ISS and say, here's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be approved?
Right.
And they wouldn't give an answer. Or we'll tell you, you know, they'd tell them on the eve of the meeting when it was too late. So everybody was pissed off. And so Jamie has this meeting with us, and he says he's going to create a business so a company can come to them and pay for their advisory service. And in effect, we'll tell you now, if you pay for the service, whether your plan is going to pass or not. So companies, and I think the magic number was $17,000. So if XYZ company has a plan or a couple of plans, well, if $17,000 is not even a footnote on a big company's money. Mm-hmm. So I said, why not? I'll pay $17,000, and Jamie will tell me whether it's going to pass or not. And if it's not going to pass, he'll tell me how to adjust it. And now, so I said to Jamie, so he's saying this is going to be his business. And I said, Jamie, that's unethical. No one's going to pay you $17,000. I mean, that's just, you can't walk both sides of the street. I don't think it'll work as a, you know. So he said, well, we're going to do it. And I said, okay. And so in the beginning, some companies said, why not? We'll pay the 17. And I only know of one instance where someone paid the 17 and they didn't get the vote. And I know the person, the corporate secretary, as well. And I said, man, boy, you must be livid, you know? And he was. But they're still doing it. And now they're not in a little room garage in Bethesda. They're a huge, huge company that's been sold a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And Jamie Heard is, you know, a multimillionaire, so it worked. I think it's a tremendous conflict still. ISS, the CGQ, I think now is not as as godlike as it once was.
CGQ.
What?
CGQ is...
Corporate Governance Quotient. Okay. They rated everybody.
Oh, okay. That's their metric.
That's their metrics.
Right, okay.
Everybody has their metrics. GMI has their metrics. Walman had his mm-hmm. metrics. But ISS is the big gorilla in the room, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Hewlett-Packard Compact deal was waiting right. for ISS to advise on 12% of the vote. So everybody's, you know, what do you... I think it's outrageous. But it's unregulated. They say they are registered as an investment company under the 40 Act. That doesn't mean anything. No one wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. I think that's still true. Carl Barnicle, just mention ISS, he'll go bananas. Ask him to tell you about ISS. Carl and I led the charge against ISS. Carl in particular, it's like, you'll see. He'll smile when you ask him. The power that they wield is, and their research is flawed. It's a check your box mentality still. To me, and I don't think this is for the oral history, but to me they are a private regulator in some ways as powerful as the SEC and influence corporate behavior. They're a private unregulated regulator. They have the temerity, the call to act like a regulator. Now they send, when they're changing their criteria, they send it out for comment to the companies, just like the SEC does. And then if people give them negative comments, then at the end of the day, when they go ahead with them anyway, they say, well, we put it out for comment. Everybody had their chance to, you know, sort of a McCarthy tactic. When did you stop beating your wife?
Hello, we are not available now.
Keep going. I'm pretty much have been through all the questions okay. I was going to ask. Is there anything else you'd like to cover?
No, I hope that's the kind of stuff you want
to
hear.
Oh, this is tremendous.
Really?
Well, oh, yeah. It's been fascinating. It's a completely different side.
It's not as heavy on the you'll get from Hank and Carl mm-hmm. A much more in-depth, better description of the issues that they in-depth. I mean, Carl was very involved in Section 16, mm-hmm. which was a huge deal when I first started Section 16 and the Forms 3, 4, and 5. Hank's going to go back into the, you know, the certainly the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And Hank has been... not only chairman and CEO of Bethlehem, he's on a lot of president. You probably Googled him and stuff. Been on a lot of presidential commissions yeah. and stuff.
Yeah.
Good guy, very good.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for.
Well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Good. I enjoyed meeting you and doing this. And yeah, I knew it would be a.